Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are back to our full hour of conversation tonight, and what better way to return to it as we discuss politics, race, and America in 2024. We're sitting down with thought leader and New York Times best-selling author Bakari Sellers. His latest effort is The Moment. Thoughts on race reckoning that wasn't, and how we can all move forward. Bakari, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
No, shout out to WHUR, your listeners at 96.3. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. So let's get right into some of the news of the day. I want to start with the historic Donald Trump hush money trial. Your reaction to where we are so far? Opening arguments today, prosecution calling David Pecker, the former head of AMI, the parent company of the National Enquirer, et cetera, et cetera. Your thoughts?
So, I mean, it's been an interesting day. I think the jury selection is something that is very, very interesting. I think when you look at the jurors and where they get their news from, juror number five, been talking about that juror for a period of time. They get their news from TikTok and the Breakfast Club, right? And then you have another juror that gets their information from Truth Social. So it's just been a very interesting selection of jurors. That's first. The opening arguments, I've always thought that this case in New York was the weakest of the four cases. I thought the exposure and the strongest case is probably the classified documents case and the Georgia case. Some people may have a hard time wrapping their head around the classified documents case because they think other people have done it and they don't understand the levels of obstruction that the president went through or the former president went through. And so that means Georgia is probably the strongest, although it won't come to a head anytime soon. What we saw today, though, is that I may have been wrong about my thoughts about the strengths of this case. The prosecution laid out what appears to be a very strong case. And by starting out with David Pecker, they're starting out with one of the best witnesses they have and laying out what the president has done or former president has done and how he did it to affect the election, which is the most important element of the crime.
You know, I wanted to kind of bring some of those points up that you just talked about. Is it possible that the average Joe and Jane don't care? Obviously, I care. I'm in the news business. I've asked some of my friends on social media just over the last hour, but keeping in mind these are, you know, my friends, my associates, people in my orbit that care about this. Shelley says absolutely, because if convicted, he will no longer be the Republican nominee. Ronette, who is an attorney, she says she doesn't believe he's going to go to jail even if convicted. Stacy says they don't file criminal charges, no go to court based on, she uses air quotes, saying fake news. And Ardenia says, I do care, especially because it's not about hush money paid to an individual. It's about the laws that were broken in a comprehensive scheme to publish potentially damning stories about number 45 and make up stories. Obviously, like I said, these are my friends. These are well-rounded, educated, and engaged people. But for the people on, the people on the street, do they care?
I mean, my friends ain't that well-rounded. Yeah. I don't know who I'm hanging out with, but your friends all got degrees on the wall and stuff.
Well, that's, and that's true. And honestly, more than me.
So, I think a lot of people, I think the overwhelming majority of people that are not in your friend circle are desensitized to this. Mm-hmm. And this election, like I tell people, I think people analyze this race all wrong. People have made this Donald Trump versus Joe Biden. And I tell everybody it's Donald Trump versus Joe Biden versus the couch. And the couch is more dangerous to Joe Biden than Donald Trump ever could be. The threat is people staying home. The threat isn't, is Donald Trump going to run up the numbers? Because he has what we call in the business, he has a low ceiling and a high floor when it comes to his presidential numbers. People do not care about this particular trial. It is sensationalized. There are no cameras in the courtroom. There's so much other stuff going on in the world. Inflation is still bothering people at the grocery store. So this is not as big of an issue as it would. This probably would be close to the trial of the century, like O.J. Simpson, if there were cameras in the courtroom. But there are no cameras in the courtroom. If we could see Donald Trump falling asleep at the table, if you could hear him farting while he's at the table, that's one thing, right? But we don't have access to those visuals. All we have are sketch. But the way that we look at this, those of us who do this every single day, who analyze these races, who comment on these races, is the fact that this a guilty verdict, which I believe is highly likely, the facts of this particular case as they come out over the next few weeks will hurt Donald Trump around the edges. It will hurt him with particularly suburban white women. It'll hurt him with those individuals who live in the suburbs of Virginia, for example, or who live in the suburbs of Milwaukee or Detroit or Minnesota or Clark County or Tucson, Arizona, or Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, or Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. All of those suburbs, I just named the states that are going to determine the president of the United States. Will this is where a hit ever so slightly, if there are enough of your friends in those respective areas, it will matter. It will matter.
I want to talk about some other political things. Last week, the House passed this funding for supporting Ukraine, as well as, you know, money for Israel. But there seems to be, and I'm speaking anecdotally, that there seems to be more concern about, you know, for Black people, for example, and young people, about what's happening between Israel and Gaza, and even outside of the Black, the young Black people thing, just young people. We see what's happening at Columbia University today, the huge protests and the Yale aspect of it. Are these things capturing the attention of young Black people more than other coffee table issues for young Black people in this country?
I mean, you can answer that question. Are they protesting at Howard?
Not much.
Okay, so the question there is answered. I think that there also is a larger question of whether or not these young people are voters, and they usually do not have it. And I'm just looking purely from a political analysis. Joe Biden would benefit exponentially with younger voters with the cessation of fire between now and the election. If there is a ceasefire between now and the election, he will benefit greatly. Now ask yourself this question. We framed it the way that I would analyze this race in a three-person race. There is nobody who believes that there was a disproportionate reaction from Israel in Gaza who will then jump over Joe Biden to vote for Donald Trump. That is illogical at best. If your plight is empathizing with Palestinians in Gaza, there is no way you can believe that Donald Trump will make that situation better. There's no world in which that happens. And so then you now have the couch that comes into play. I think the president's been working diligently along with Jake Sullivan and many others to have a cessation of fire. I firmly believe that it's very, very difficult for the for Israel to negotiate with a regime that does not believe they have the right to exist in Hamas. I also think on the other side, I think Bibi Netanyahu is one of the larger impediments to peace in the region and stability in the region. He has become his own vein, somewhat MAGA. And he's been that way since Barack Obama was president of the United States. I believe this is a very nuanced conversation that people do not have, usually at a time or bandwidth. October 7th is one of the most devastating days in the history of the world. I've actually been to a kibbutz and held a Qassam rocket in the same kibbutz that was massacred and families were massacred on October 7th. And I don't think we can forget that. I think there's a question about the proportionality of the response and the innocent journalists, men, women, and children that have been killed in Gaza. And I think your heart can break for them all. Now, on college campuses, the rise of anti-Semitism is real. You know, the Jewish kids who are being assaulted and degraded and put upon on these campuses need to be protected. Outside the gates, those groups that are coming in and permeating that violence and riling up that violence, they need to be dealt with. And so it's just a number of factors that are coming to a head, and we'll see what result, if any. I think to answer your question directly, the impact on November will be negligible.
Yeah. One of the things that did come out of that House vote, and I don't think it operates obviously in a background, and it's not the first time, but it is the muscular exacerbation of the voice of Marjorie Taylor Greene. And the fact that she is constantly being a right-wing rabble-rouser. But again, through the lens of race, I ask you the same question that I asked in the beginning of this conversation. What the heck is going on? Because I would
argue, I mean, I sent you a whole book.
Yeah.
read the book. What's going on? The monetization of racism. How old are you? What year were you born?
1964. I know black don't crack.
But. You don't. You've been drinking your water and minding your business. You look really good.
Well, not minding my business, but definitely drinking my water.
the fact is this. You remember, you're old enough to remember, as am I was only born in 1984, when being racist was not cool. When racism was pushed to the edges in the darkest parts, where we knew that one racist, right, or whatever, we didn't know everybody's thoughts and opinions on everything. And how right now, though, I will tell you that the white hood and sheets with the eyes cut out has been replaced by a Brooks Brothers suit, and they now have their own show on Fox News or conservative talk radio. There is a inherent capitalistic value to racism right now. And Donald Trump used racism as a political currency in 2016. Whenever you have somebody like Tucker Carlson, who I talk about in the book a lot, using talking about the great replacement theory, which is a white supremacist ideology, on national cable news in front of millions of people, you identify that racism has some value. And you have major corporations running ads to pay this man's salary. So you ask me what's happening. You have the, I believe that the word is commoditization. I think maybe an economic professor can correct me if I'm wrong, but you have the making racism a commodity, because I'm from Denmark. We got three stoplights and a blinking light, so I might have mauled that word. But you have the ability to make racism a commodity in this country, and that's what we're seeing.
I want to also, to your point, I have so many questions about the book, but why the title, The Moment? Where does that come from?
So there are a couple of moments in which I talk about specifically, but the book, The Moment, that where it came from is I was on TV after George Floyd. Mm-hmm. Was on with Allison Camerata and Jake and John Berman. And I was in the segment with Dante Stallworth, and it was back during COVID. I looked like a young Teddy Pendergrass. My hair was grown out, had an afro.
I remember.
Yeah.
I do remember.
And the segment before me was Felonious Floyd, George's brother, and Ben Crump. And they were just having a really emotional conversation. And it came to me, and I broke down. I was asking about, what do I tell my kids being black in this country? My daughter was upstairs. She's now a freshman at Howard. My twins were in our bed as they normally did. They would crawl out of their sleep. What do you call it? The nurseries. And they would come in our room. And for me, it was just a very painful realization that there was a lot of pain in our communities and a lot of pain in how we're raising Black children in this country. And for me, George Floyd meant that much. And it was a moment. And COVID was a moment. And the question was, how do we react to those moments? And so I would articulate in this book that it was a racial reckoning that wasn't. And maybe it was, you know, my youth and believing that we would finally have a time where this world and country in particular could empathize with the plight and pain of Black folk. But, you know, I was wrong. And I admit I was wrong in the book. I start the book, speaking of moments, talking about a picture of my father. And it's
Hold on just 1 second, because I don't want you to lose that point, but I have to take a really quick break. We are talking to New York Times bestselling author Bakari Sellers about his latest effort, The Moment, thoughts on race reckoning that wasn't, and how we can all move forward now. I'm going to take a quick break, but don't forget, you can see every edition of the Daily Drum on WHUR.com. That podcast is posted every night after 9 o'clock. The original Quiet Storm is next. That's on WHUR. We continue with this conversation on SiriusXM channel 141 in just a bit. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on SiriusXM channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. This is the Insight segment, and we continue our conversation tonight with thought leader and New York Times bestselling author Bakari Sellers. His latest effort is The Moment, thoughts on the race reckoning that wasn't, and how we can all move forward. Before the break, you were talking about the title, The Moment, and how you got to that, and you were talking about your father. Please continue.
Yeah, no, one of the other moments I talk about and where the book starts is my father is in front of the, my father had just been bonded out of jail for protesting in front of the South African embassy in New York. My father in the picture is Jim Foreman, John Lewis, and there are two individuals who stand out in the picture. One is Harry Belafonte and the other is Sidney Poitier. And the reason they stand out is because they had just bonded these young SNCC warriors out of jail. And we talk about the intersection of history, culture, entertainment, wealth, and grassroots activism and civil rights activism. And it's just a powerful segue to figuring out where we are today. And my father articulates that we're back in 1954, 55. We're back in Brown v. Board of Education. That's where he views us to be. And I push back on that a little bit. And so that's how we start the book in this kind of interesting dialogue we have around the issue of race.
Well, I can see their position, obviously. You know, I was not there, but you mentioned, you know, George Floyd and the shock value of his murder. And we saw how individuals, municipalities, government officials, corporations rushed to the fore to try to address the horror of what happened to George Floyd. But, you know, relatively speaking, it just seems that none of that has lasted.
That's objective. I mean, it's not relatively speaking. I mean, you just stated an objective fact. Mm-hmm. But negates everything before it. Period. Let's have a conversation about why George Floyd happened. Right. So you have a young Black girl who had the audacity to take out her phone and take a pic and videotape this. You have a Black man who has a white officer's knee in the back of his neck for 9 minutes. You have him screaming out for his mother. And what people forget is that you had COVID, right? I dare say that George Floyd would not happen if we were not in COVID. The George Floyd moment would not happen if we were not in COVID.
Because why? People, why do you say that?
because you couldn't go anywhere because you had to watch the video. You weren't going to work. You weren't doing your daily task. You had no choice. You couldn't turn your head away from it. It played, the video played repeatedly. So it was seared in our heads. Like, because we were in COVID, because the world was frozen, you had no choice but to watch and hear this man's pain. You had no choice but to watch and see his death. And by watching that death on camera, it drove millions of people around the world out to the streets. And so think about that critically. You had a young Black girl who had the audacity to film. You had a gruesome murder on camera. You had COVID, which is a once in a 100-year phenomenon. And you had protests from around the world. It took all of that just to have accountability with police in this country, just for Derek Chauvin to go to prison. That's not justice. Justice is George Floyd being here. But it took all of those things to occur at one particular time in American history for us to have accountability. And so that, to me, helps explain the George Floyd phenomenon. And when you look at it as such, you realize how difficult and how high a bar that is.
One of the other things that I think is particularly disturbing, and we see this every day, even in local news, we see this in our, even in our coverage of the some of the outer suburbs, the exurbs, and the close-in rural communities of the DMV, and that is book banning, where we're having, you know, librarians under attack, libraries under attack, education under attack, when organizations are asking that books about people of color, specifically Black people, people, you know, in the LGBTQ community, those, you know, books that talk about identity, not only should be, you know, removed, but there seems to be a movement to erase history. And again, this is not new, but it just seems to have gained so much momentum. What are your thoughts on that? And is there a way to get back to understanding that good or bad, that saying those who forget history are doomed to repeat it?
Yeah, for me, I would argue that that's the height of anti-intellectualism. That mm-hmm. what we're seeing right now is a manifestation of that fear, right? That's what we're talking about when we're talking about the fear that people are seeing. When we're talking about the fear of in the Great Replacement Theory, or the fear of the Browning of America, that this is a manifestation of just that. And so what we have to do, and the weird part about it, is how do we fight back, right? That's the weird part about it. How do we fight back? How do we go through a position, and how do we do everything we need to do to ensure that the history that we want, the history that we want to be taught, that our stories are being told? That's the largest question we have, is how do we make sure that those things occur? And you know, that's why, you know, I tell people all the time, you have to take this into your own hands. We have to educate our own children about our own story. Nobody's going to know how great Marion Barry is unless we tell the story of Marion Barry.
Right. Yeah.
Period. I mean, Marion Barry is arguably the greatest American mayor of any major city in the history of the country. Period. But no one will know that unless we tell that story.
But I think to, you know,
to, I thought you were about to say something bad about Marion. I was about to say, I don't let nobody talk bad about Marion now.
Well, no, well, I'm a native Washingtonian.
Okay. So you know.
yeah, I know. You know, that's not an issue for me. I will say, as an aside, when you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, when I was a a TV news reporter in Alabama, and I would talk to people, and they would say, where are you from? And I would say, Washington, D.C. And they would say, oh, gosh, that's where, you know, Marion Barry was. And he was, you know, smoking crack on TV. And I said, well, yes, we saw that. But there was so much more to him. And yes, I had, you know, those extensive conversations about Black business, Black contracting, about
making, summer lunch program.
Yeah, the
job program, excuse me.
Summer youth program, SYEP, Summer Youth Employment Program, getting seniors to the polls who otherwise would not be able to get to the polls to vote. That's a whole different conversation. But yes, I definitely understand that. But I think, I think is the quandary, and particularly when you're talking about books like The Moment. Uh-huh. There's so much great information, but you know, for a lot of people, I'm in the choir. Bakari Sellers is preaching to the choir. How do you bring other people inside the Church of Bakari Sellers, the Church of the Moment, to sit down and listen to a difficult sermon if they are not of the culture of color?
Yeah. Well, first of all, if anybody ever seen me drink tequila, they'll tell you I ain't preaching to nobody. That's a good question. In the book, I state what I hold to be true. It's an opinion that I assert as fact, which is what a lot of people do when they write books. But I say that the country won't change unless white male evangelicals want it to. And your question makes me ponder. You know, there's certain conversations that you and I simply can't have. There's certain places where you and I, this message that we're carrying of racial reckoning, et cetera, just would not be received. And so I guess my prayer, more so than my preaching, is that somebody picks up the book, somebody who doesn't look like you and I, and understand that there is a pain that's innate to our experience. There are generations of trauma, and that their task is to go in within their own communities and have these very difficult conversations about why that necessary fear exists.
But can there be education of the masses outside the 12% of the Black population in this country and the other population of people who do not look like us, who do care? But outside of those, can there be a message of, this is what happened, you need to know, but you don't have to be afraid of the history. You just have to understand the history.
That's true. I mean, like, I don't want anybody to feel guilty about it. I don't want anybody to think any less of themselves because of this country's history. I just want it to be accurate. You know, when I was in the State House, well, before I got to the State House, actually, but behind the South Carolina State House, there is a huge monument to Strom Thurmond.
Mm.
And we had the artist had to go back, and you can visibly see it on the statue, had to erase 4 and put 5, where it listed his children. And then it had to go and add Essie May, who was the oldest of his children. They literally had to go in and etch it. I ain't trying to make anybody feel bad about nothing. That, you know, you deal with that, and you and your God deal with that. But it's accurate now, right? The history is accurate. So when people look at the monument, the history is accurate. And so I just want there to be, we don't even know what the truth is anymore. I mean, you have people like Tucker and Candace Owens who are out here saying that the moon landing was fake and 9/11 was an inside job and the Holocaust is not real. Like, what are we talking about? like we have to get back to a place where we're having honest, truthful conversations with one another.
So, and okay, you just struck a nerve with me. Why does that happen?
I didn't strike. They the ones doing it. They struck the nerve.
That's my point. That, yeah, I mean, that your comment bringing up that, and then you know, you talk about talking to people who say the Earth is flat. And why is that happening? Is it that it has always?
It's always been there. Ignorance is not.
Yeah,
ignorance is not new, but ignorance is
up. Yeah.
Yeah, because there's a monetization of it. I mean, we talked about the fact that racism is now a commodity. Same thing here. I mean, this makes money for people, right? Mm. And so because it makes money, it makes sense, and they will continue to do it. I mean, this would still be in the shadows if there was not a place for it. I mean, Tucker Carlson went on the largest podcast in the world, the Joe Rogan Experience, having conversations like this. I mean, this isn't. You know, Tucker had an entire platform. Sean Hannity still has a platform where advertisers pay millions of dollars for, you know, people like Stephen A. Smith to come on national TV and have the audacity to say that Donald Trump's indictments make him relatable to Black folk.
Hmm. I don't have a criminal record, so, and I'm Black.
But that's not even the point.
Yeah.
The point is that my father has a criminal record, right? My father was arrested February 8th, 1968, when he was shot along with 28 others who were wounded and three who were killed in the Orangeburg Massacre. My father has a record for not going to Vietnam. So my father got a pardon but didn't want his record expunged. But there's a difference between the persecution that my father went through and the prosecution that Donald Trump is going through.
I was about to say the same thing, but your father's air quotes criminal history and what Donald Trump is going through, those are not the same.
Correct. That one is a persecution. His name was Cleveland Sellers. The other is a prosecution. His name is Donald J. Trump. Yeah. And that was for Stephen A. Smith.
I want to talk to you also about, you know, one of the other conversations, and this is something that comes out of the book as well. And on this program, we talk about this at least one, twice, 12 times a year, is the importance of generational wealth. And this is an economic issue for Black people. And it seems that for whatever reason, anecdotally speaking, as much as we talk about it, it is becoming more difficult to acquire.
What's the question?
You did
one of those Don Lemon Chris Cuomo things where you just statement and then we're supposed to go up with the question.
Just put it out there. Yeah.
Put it out there. Yeah. So, you know. By most metrics, we've gone backwards. So the best metric for me to give you is Black home ownership today is where it was in 1968. Right. And I think that the number one metric based upon the National Urban League and most economists who'll talk to you to tell you what wealth looks like is through the ownership of your home.
Now, you're talking about 68. Pre-Fair Housing Act or 68?
Pre-Fair Housing Act. Because remember, the Fair Housing Act didn't pass until after April of 1968. Because what happened April 4th of 68? Assassination of King. Right. And that's the only reason that the Fair Housing Act passed. And so, you know, that I'm just using that. I don't want to get into the history of the Fair Housing Act. I'm just using that as a metric to show you where we are economically. Another thing is, how many Black owners you have of a professional football team?
Right. Well, then there's
all right. That. I mean, the cheapest one is about $2.2 billion. Now ask yourself this question. How many Black folk do you know in this country that can write a $2.2 billion check? I would say none.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, let's use home ownership. Let's use professional football. Let's use whatever metric you want. we still have a lot of first-time college graduates. Mm-hmm. We just do. First-generation college graduates. We still are struggling many times to survive, which I've always articulated as one of my goals, to get us out of this mode of survival and into thriving. You need to have as a guest, and I don't know if you've ever had him, but I will plug you up with him after the show, but Reverend Dr. William Barber articulated your message probably the clearest. I interview him in my book. He talks about the way that we actually bring folk together. It's going to start with poor whites and poor Black folk, and we got to have a conversation because there is a nexus and a commonality between the two.
But what is getting in the way of generational Black wealth outside of obviously the
nothing? Economic? Nothing's getting in the way of it. But we've only been a republic since 65.
Yeah, but
I don't know. We can't catch up in. I don't do math. I'm a lawyer. I only count by thirds. So what's
I know the feeling.
24. That's like 69 years. I mean, we can't catch up in 69 years.
But this is why I ask, because obviously home ownership is foundational to, to Black wealth. And we can talk about mortgage rates, which are getting in the way of just about everything.
We can talk about credit reports. My credit report dropped yesterday, and I mean, on Friday, and I still don't know why.
It could have been that restaurant that you ate in with your
American. No, it wasn't even my credit usage is good. They sent me a note that says sometimes it goes up and sometimes it goes down based upon the metrics that are used. That's what I'm saying. And like, you have what gets in the way are systemic issues and barriers, which are preventative. Implicit biases, such as those in appraisals. I mean, if you get your house appraised right now, I believe you would take down all your Black pictures. I mean, that's what we do in the South. I don't know if you do it up there, but it is
a thing here. Just to digress just a little bit, a year or so ago, there was a professor at Johns Hopkins who lived in one of Baltimore City's old money neighborhoods, had his house appraised. It was appraised, I don't know, maybe about $400,000. And he said, And so he had one of the white professors, a colleague from Johns Hopkins, come in. And I believe it was the same company. He took down all of his Black pictures. House was appraised at $700,000. And big, big story in Baltimore a year or so ago. Fascinating story. Don't know what, I know that he had filed some legal stuff, a lawsuit and the like. Don't know where that is at the moment. We actually tried to talk to him. But to your point, South Carolina, Maryland, California, yes, that certainly remains an issue, economics rate.
So I mean, in the barriers, I mean, let's go to how we educate our youth. I mean, Maryland, who listens to 96.3, Merlin. You know how y'all say Merlin?
Like some of us do, but my
Merlin. Merlin was a magician. For example, I mean, they just had to remedy and rectify the underfunding of their historically Black colleges and universities.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, just it all ties in together. Black women are still three times more likely to die during childbirth than white women. The economic impact of that. I mean, my wife nearly died giving birth to the twins. And so when you talk about that, we're still paying for her ICU visit. So, I mean, you talk about the impediments to wealth. I think you have to take a holistic approach and look through a lens that's broad enough to see many of the systemic ills that ail us today.
In these last 5 minutes or so, I do want to talk about the election. Admittedly, and you know this, Barack Obama is a hard act to follow for Black folks, okay? And even in an imperfect presidency, but what needs to happen to mobilize the Black vote? Again, I talk about the young Black vote. Is it still too early? We've got primaries all over the place. And and this isn't about whether you should vote for Biden or Trump, but I'm just talking about the black young black people in general, or just black people. It just doesn't seem to be a lot of excitement around this election.
Yeah. You know, for a long period of time, I've said this a few times, but, you know, Democrats fall in this trope, for lack of a better term, of subject verb Trump, right? And there has to be an active messaging cycle in which you tell us what you're going to do for us going forward. Both of these candidates fall into a habit of living in the past. Both of them fall into a habit of talking about what used to be or what they have done instead of articulating a vision for the future. And that's what young people want to hear. Young people want to hear how you're going to make my plight for the future better, or how you're going to lessen my load. I think that probably instead of asking me this question, I'm interested to hear what students at Howard University or George Mason or American think about this election cycle, because their voices are going to be the ones that matter. I think black men are going to be the most consequential voting bloc in this election.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested to see the results of what happens in November.
Final question, the sports question, with, you know, the Dawn Staley at the University of South Carolina not getting the kind of publicity that some people think that she deserved. She was, you know, criticized for talking about her faith, you know, after winning the NCAA championship. What are your thoughts about that? And admittedly, and my listeners know, I'm not a big basketball fan, women's basketball.
I'm sitting in front of you today with a women's Gamecock sweatshirt on. I'm starting my press run representing Dawn and my girls who won the national championship. Dawn is one of the most consequential figures in American history. She is somebody I love. She's family. What she does for these young ladies is remarkable. And she doesn't need a white gaze, G-A-Z-E. She does not need to be white adjacent. She's very, very comfortable and happy being a powerful black woman. And I said it early and I say it everywhere. If Kai, who I hope is listening, who is my freshman at Howard University, can be half the woman Dawn Staley is when she grows up, her life will be a success.
What do you want people to take away from your book?
That we've made progress, but we still have yet a ways to go. Life is a journey. It's not a singular step, but a collection thereof. And I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful because of the young people. I'm hopeful because of Sadie and Stokely. And I'm hopeful that tomorrow will be better than yesterday.
Bakari Sellers, again, the book is titled The Moment, Thoughts on the Race Reckoning That Wasn't, and How We All Move Forward Now. I really appreciate you taking the time, spending some time with us.
I'll be in Baltimore on Wednesday, and I'll be at Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C. on Friday. And Thursday, I'm in Philadelphia. So if you have family members in any of those places, next week is St. Louis and Chicago. So looking forward to seeing people out on the tour.
What's your website?
BakariSellers.com.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, just between us brothers, if your daughter needs $20, she can come to the radio station. She can hit me up because I know you're good for it.
Okay. Yeah. Just ask me for a Cash App. You'll get it eventually.
Bakari Sellers, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
All right. Much love. Thank you. Appreciate you.
Sure thing. That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, April 22nd. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.
All right. Peace, brother. Thank you.